Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yu Yunzhan, host of our monthly podcast Zhonghua Mundus, that brings you recent updates about China's economy. As usual, I am with our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia Herrero, who is the co-host of this show. Hi, Alicia. Welcome to have you back.
Thank you, Yu Yun. Very happy to be here with Plamen. You're going to introduce him right away, I know.
Exactly. We're also happy to have with us today Plamen Tonchev, who is the head of Asia Unit at the Athens-based Institute of International Economic Relations. Nice to meet you, Plamen, and welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Thanks very much, Yu Yun, and pleasure to be with you, Alicia, as well.
Today, we are diving a bit into China's economic presence in the Eastern Mediterranean, a region that we have not covered much before in terms of its relations with China. The geostrategic value of the region has historically attracted external powers trying to increase their influence here, and China has been an increasingly important player in the region. Plamen, could you give us an overview of how Eastern Mediterranean region fits into China's geo-economic interests?
Well, I think that all one needs to do is have a look at the map and immediately realize the significance of the Eastern Mediterranean. If anything, it sits on the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, and in particular on the maritime Silk Road through the Suez Canal into the Mediterranean, and then further on to Europe. And the second inevitable point is that, of course, China is very much interested in having its economic ties with Europe, which is a major market for Chinese exports. So the Eastern Mediterranean is a natural entry point for China into the European sphere, to put it that simply.
Indeed. Alicia, could you give an overview of how China's economic presence in this region has been?
I actually think Plamen can give a much better overview, but I can make a more general point on China's presence in Europe and then listen to Plamen as to how this might be different. Let me start from with this amazing news because it says it all about where we stand. So basically, we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of EU-China relations. And Xi Jinping has declined to visit Brussels. We will have, once again, Van der Leyen and this time around Costa going to China. And at the same time, Xi Jinping is basically spending 5 days in Russia with Putin. Why is this important? Because it shows that really matters for China and certainly for Xi Jinping is the member states, the granularity of the member states. And that is everything but Europe in the sense of, you know, Brussels institutions. So if that's your policy, there has to be a reason. I think it's simply easier. Maybe you just don't understand how Europe works and you believe that at some point it may not even be there and that the only thing that remains is, you know, the actual nations. So what do you do then? You look at periphery because it's easier. Yeah, you look at entry points. And there's several entry points. We all know the entry points. Those entry points are increasing in number because China is becoming more influential overall and all the more so in the Trump era. So, you know, I would say that this is kind of the way to understand this. This is kind of not special, I would say, necessarily, although I'm sure Plamen can bring some ideas why, you know, Chinese presence in this part of Europe is in some way special. But the essence of China coming along to all of these different regions is not special, is the way in which China can leverage and have more influence rather than going, you know, straight to the core, which would be European institutions. I think the big exception and probably no longer the case, the elephant in the room is Germany. I mean, how such a big country can have, I don't know whether I should use the word suffer, but I do believe it suffered from such a massive influence from China. which I think is very asymmetric because Germany doesn't have that influence anymore on China whatsoever. So in a way, although China is entering through every single entry point, it is also true that it has, in a way, dominated the narrative of the largest country in Europe as far as China is concerned. So I mean, this is a winning strategy. Yeah, you get the heart, Germany, and then you enter through, you know, all of the peripheral points. So by now, China's influence in Europe is massive for that reason. And I leave it here, and I very much want to hear from Plamen as to what's special about this part of Europe.
If I can step in here, because I like, Alethea, your point. I mean, this broader perspective you bring in. Indeed, I would add that the Eastern Mediterranean is a funny mix of countries which belong to the EU and the West, and then countries which belong to the global South. It's a meeting point in many ways. Think of Greece and Cyprus being EU member states. And then think of Israel, which very, very, very much belongs to the West. Turkey has a customs union. It's part of the customs union with the EU. It's a candidate for accession to the EU, officially, at least. And then you have countries that clearly belong to the global South, like Egypt, Libya, Syria, and Lebanon. So it's a very interesting meeting point, which allows China to test some of its strategies and, of course, get closer to both the EU and the global South.
Indeed, it's a very complicated region. So that's why I want to break down into individual countries and look at them more closely. And then we can talk about like Chinese strategies into each different country. So let's zoom in to the first country that I want to bring out is Egypt. So China has been Egypt's biggest trade partner, and there has been some substantial Chinese investment in the country, for example. Alethea, do you want to give us an overview of how has the relations evolved recently?
Well, I mean, Egypt at some point, and Plamen must know much more, but, you know, from my research looking at, in a way, very nerdily and maybe not knowing enough as to, you know, the really political and soft power relations between Egypt and China. But what I can tell you from looking at lending data and investment data is that Egypt was actually very important. Main reason was, you know, the construction of this new capital. And I got very interested about this because, you know, because when looking at the data up to 2019, Egypt was probably the biggest recipient of greenfield investment. That is the way it was characterized, although it was construction. Yeah. And in other cases, interestingly, not Egypt, but in other cases where China would be building stuff, it would be loans. Project finance loans. But in Egypt, it was greenfield. And I guess there probably was, you know, an understanding maybe that Egypt couldn't take too much more debt and that, you know, this had to be basically a co-investment, if you see what I mean. But what this shows is that China is very flexible in really getting where it wants to get with the instruments that are needed to get the deal. And, you know, this gives China a lot of power that Europe doesn't really have. If Europe were to compete in building this, it's just not possible because we wouldn't be able to do that, if you see what I mean. So, you know, for me, what I think this shows is that even in circumstances where you would have imagined that Egypt would not have turned, you know, towards China for a number of reasons related to its political situation after the Arab Spring, and yet China managed because it found a way. And I think this is something we Europeans need to understand, that we need to be much leaner and more flexible. And sometimes, you know, no matter whether we like it or not, I understand that we have our values, our principles. I'm not saying we need to give them up, but we need to find ways to be more agile in what we do. because I think that is what I can see about this relation in particular, which would have been surprising otherwise.
Thank you for that. Plamen, do you want to chip in here?
Yes, I'll pick one of Alethea's points that indeed the Chinese have always had a very flexible approach to specific regions and countries. I would call it highly customized, you know, country-specific or region-specific. In the case of Egypt, they have been very successful indeed. And I think one of the success stories, one of the spectacular successes of China in Egypt is the so-called Suez Canal Economic Zone, which is a very interesting case study we should carefully look at. And if I may present the key parameters of this story, let me tell you that it was promoted by the so-called TIDA Industrial Park in Tianjin in China. In fact, I think that TIDA stands for Tianjin Economic Technological Development Area. This is what the acronym stands for. And this industrial park, well, in fact, to the south of the Suez Canal, on the western shore of the Red Sea, it was funded by TIDA and also the China Africa Development Fund. It's a huge industrial park. Very many Chinese companies now operate in it. And in fact, I would say that the Suez Canal Economic Zone is increasingly looking like a miniature of China itself, a mini China, so to speak. And interestingly, of course, the Suez Canal Economic Zone was heavily affected by the recent crisis in the Red Sea. Mind you, in 2024, last year, the revenue, Egypt's revenue from the Suez Canal plummeted from 10 billion a year earlier to less than 4 billion. And yet, now the Suez Canal Economic Zone is quickly recovering. And it's not only that Chinese companies are heavily invested in this particular industrial park. They are omnipresent in Egypt across the whole of the country. According to at least official Beijing sources, recently, by March 2025, the overall bulk, the overall volume of Chinese investment in Egypt exceeded $7 billion, and there's more coming, I mean $7 billion. And let me also tell you that apart from the Suez Canal Economic Zone, Chinese companies are heavily involved in the construction of a central business district in Egypt's new administrative capital. Let me tell you that recently, last December, Egypt's Suez Wind Energy signed an agreement with a huge power construction corporation from China to build a 1 gigawatt wind farm in the Gulf of Suez. Energy China, yet another a big player, and of course it's state-owned, plans to build a $5 billion plant that will export ammonia to European markets. There's the Chinese motor vehicle maker Bike, which has announced that it will establish an electric car factory in Egypt. But interestingly, the scope of Sino-Egyptian economic ties does not only cover civilian sectors, it also extends to military cooperation. For instance, there are persistent reports about ongoing negotiations between Beijing and Cairo over the procurement of Chinese cutting-edge aircraft, including the J-10C fighter. You may be aware of the recent joint air drills in Egypt with the code name Eagles of Civilization 2025. And there's talk of Egypt seriously considering purchasing this Chinese fighter. And there are many reports that, in fact, Egypt may also purchase missiles and other, you know, military equipment from China. It has already officially confirmed that it is using long-range surface-to-air missile systems from China. So not only are Sino-Egyptian economic ties becoming increasingly close, but they are also acquiring military and geopolitical dimensions. So we are inevitably stepping into the realm of geopolitics as well when we speak about China and Egypt.
Are there any concerns about the energy security sovereignty when we have seen these deepening ties between China and Egypt?
I think that Alethea already hinted at concerns about Egypt's indebtedness to China, which is a serious issue. When it comes to energy security and dependence on all these Chinese companies in Egypt, I think that so far the two countries have managed to strike a fairly reasonable balance in the sense that Chinese companies, of course, help Egypt to increase its energy potential. And then Egypt is looking at the European markets, you know, in order to export all these excess amounts of energy and electricity in particular. Let me tell you that yesterday, Egypt's President al-Sisi was in Athens, and there are talks between Greece and Egypt about the construction of a high-voltage link between the two countries, so that Egypt then exports, you know, green energy electricity via Greece towards Europe further on to the north of Greece.
That's super interesting because although Egypt is not a country in the EU, but because it's such periphery, like next to the European Union countries, so we can see that how China is also gaining some influence on this front by working more with Egypt.
That's right.
Let's move on to the next country in the region, Turkey. How do you see the level of China-Turkey economic relations at the point, Alicia?
If we move to Turkey, I think this gets even more interesting because it's very different. When we talk about Egypt or small European countries, Cyprus, etc., we're talking about basically a dependent relation. Now, of course, you are a EU member, you may be more depending on the EU, but still, China is increasing its presence and creating these critical dependencies. But I think for Turkey, the relation is one in which Turkey wants to belong to this asymmetric multipolarity, being part of that multipolarity, and wants to keep its space. And this is very, very different. So this means that Turkey, for example, would have no problem in imposing tariffs on electric vehicles from China, certainly with not such a big fuss as the European Union, and at the same time cooperate with China in certain areas. But basically keeping its independence to be able to use the necessary instruments to protect its market, to protect its independence, basically. And I think that, and I want really to ask Plamen, I think a very interesting part of this is also the Ukraine, Russia, China, Turkey story. Yeah, I mean, how Turkey wants to come with a peace deal before anybody else, basically. And what's China's reaction to that? I think, although, of course, these two economies cannot compare in size, I think China realizes that Turkey can be part of that asymmetric multipolarity and treats Turkey very differently because of that. So I would say this is a different angle. It's just not the same as what we have been discussing before. So, Plamen, I'm all ears.
All right. Thanks, Alethea, for your confidence in me. I'm taking your point, and I quite agree with you that Turkey wants to retain a degree of independence, not only from China, but from the EU, from the United States. It has a solid, I would say, multi-vector policy. And you can see that it can be an ally of Russia on certain fronts and then be a competitor with Russia. And pretty much the same thing applies to Sino-Turkish relations. The two countries, Turkey and China, can cooperate in a number of fields, and then they may be competitors in other fields, and I'll come up with a couple of examples. On China's presence in Turkey, let me quickly run through some indicative projects, emblematic projects, because there are more than 1,000 Chinese companies invested in sectors of the Turkish economy, from tourism and finance to transportation, mining and energy, whatnot. A major BRI project is Costco's investment in Kumport to the west of Istanbul, even though it has not yielded any significant results to date. Of course, I'm sure you're aware of a BYD investment in an electric vehicle plant in Turkey to the tune of about $1 billion. And I understand there are ongoing negotiations, talks with yet another Chinese car maker, Chery, who are also interested in investing in a car assembly plant in Turkey. I fully agree, Alicia, that Turkey wants to preserve its domestic market, its domestic car assembly industry. Indeed, Turkey has imposed 40% tariffs on imported Chinese electric vehicles. But at the same time, Turkey has a very shrewd policy, since it is a member of the customs union with the EU. This is an extra incentive for the Chinese to invest in Turkey itself and then target the European market. I think that there are also areas where Turkey and China are competitors, or at least they may be, unlikely bedfellows. And one of these areas is the Middle Corridor. For 3 years now, we have the war in Ukraine. This has heavily affected traffic along the terrestrial route from China via Kazakhstan and Russia towards the EU. I understand that at least the traffic reduction amounts to about 40% at least. And then the Red Sea crisis also showed China that they will have to look at alternative routes towards the European markets. And this is where the Middle Corridor came in. It's always been there. It's always been promoted by Turkey. But until recently, the Chinese were kind of indifferent, not investing in this Middle Corridor. Now that things have changed, they have shown a renewed interest in the Middle Corridor, which is why they have now invested in the China-Kyrgyzstan-Uzbekistan railway track. It's been there forever, a lot of talking, but no action. And yet, now the Chinese have really given it a solid impetus. And this railway track is being not built, but at least it's being designed and possibly will be built within the next few years, which is part of the Middle Corridor towards the Caspian Sea, the Caucasus, and Turkey. At the same time, because of competition between Turkey and China, the Chinese do not want to put all their eggs in the same basket, in the Turkish basket, which is why they're also looking at, other variants of the Middle Corridor, for instance, not through Turkey, but through the Black Sea, which is why they're now investing in a new port to be constructed in Georgia, in the Black Sea basin. This port is called Anaklia, and it is being built by a Chinese construction company, which shows that, yes, China will work with Turkey on the Middle Corridor, but it will also continue to look for other alternatives away from Turkey or other than Turkey.
That's super interesting. Moving Moving on to our next country, it's also a sort of different player in the region, is Israel. As Plumman, you've said, this is part of the Western powers, and China-Israel relations have recently soured a bit, I would say, due to the Gaza conflict. Where do you see that this could affect the China-Israel relations, and how could this impact the region?
You see, over the past 3 decades at least, there's been close cooperation between Israel and China, in mostly in high-tech sectors, much to the chagrin of the United States. And we all know that the Americans have always been putting pressure on Tel Aviv to please, do not cozy up to China too much. And things have now changed quite visibly since October 23 and the Hamas attack on Israel. There's a number of sociological surveys in Israel that point to a steady deterioration of China's image in the country. And of course, this reflects on the bilateral relations as well. I'm aware of at least one survey which was carried out in September 24 in Israel. It was conducted by the Institute for National Security Studies. And according to the survey, only 16%, 1/6, of Israeli respondents view China as a friendly country. And this tells you the whole story, right? The prevailing perception in Israel is that Beijing tacitly, if not in an undisguised manner, supports Hamas and Iran. And you can imagine how this goes down with the general public in Israel. Mind you, Beijing last year, I believe it was in July 24, Beijing hosted a meeting of 14 Palestinian factions in China, and promoted a sort of a reconciliation agreement between these factions, including Fatah and Hamas. And as you can imagine, this news item received a frosty reception in Israeli media. Because of deepening Israeli distrust towards China, you can now see a lot of suspicion when it comes to the use of Chinese technology in Israel itself. Mind you, during their campaign in the Gaza Strip, the Israeli Defense Forces uncovered large stockpiles of Chinese-made weaponry in the possession of Hamas fighters, including drones, assault rifles, automatic grenade launchers, and so on. Now, it is likely that all this weaponry ended up in the hands of Hamas fighters from Iran, not Beijing, not China. But China and Iran have their close ties, and this doesn't look good. And this has further poisoned Sino-Israeli relations. There's a lot of growing distrust in Chinese tech in Israel. Let me tell you, I know it may sound funny, but you have to be aware of this. You know, Israeli soldiers are advised by their bosses that you shouldn't talk about sensitive topics while you drive a Chinese car. In fact, some experts in Israel have warned of the risks posed by 550 cars supplied by the Chinese company Chery to the Israeli Defense Forces. And interestingly, the most critical voices in Israel call for a general boycott of Chinese technology in the wake of Israel's pager attack on Hezbollah last September. You remember that attack, which was a spectacular story, resulting in thousands of injuries and deaths across Lebanon. That attack, of course, targeted Hezbollah fighters. But immediately after that, while it was seen as a huge success of the Israeli secret services, it also demonstrated the vulnerability of commercial electronic devices. And many of these electronic devices come from China. So that there are very many repercussions of, the Gaza, the conflict in Gaza, repercussions on relations between Israel and China. And now the fact that Egypt may buy Chinese fighters doesn't go down well with Israel, because Israel has always been proud of its, air superiority. And now that Egypt may actually acquire Chinese fighters, stealth fighters at that, this actually may change the balance of power in the Eastern Mediterranean. So all this has really poisoned relations between Beijing and Tel Aviv. At the same time, and I have to mention this, and I'll stop at that, there are many voices in Israel that say that, listen, we still need cooperation with China. We have a lot of imports from China, a lot of, commercial items that we need from them. So let's calm down and let's have a real assessment of the pros and cons of working with China, because China is a major market for our products. It's a major source for things that we need in Israel. So it'll be interesting to watch, the further developments in the Sino-Israeli relations, both in economic and geopolitical terms.
Indeed, yeah, that's fascinating. Alicia, do you want to chip in here?
Well, I think this is kind of the mirror of what we were discussing for Turkey. So what is Israel, Sino-Israel relations? Basically, this is Israel for, and again, today is the US biggest ally. And the fact that Israel, and I still remember again working on this M&A, China's investment data, looking at M&A operations, China's M&A, and the amount of tech companies that China bought in Israel is just unbelievable. Many were dual technology, by the way.
Right.
So, if you think about that, and I mean, understandably easy, China was very interested, relations were great, and the US wasn't really looking, maybe warning, but not a big deal. So I think the reality is that I think even before Gaza, because this starts before Gaza, and maybe I wouldn't say explains China's position, because there's many other factors to take into account, the helm of the global south, I mean trade-offs, yeah, and China couldn't have it all. So I guess, dropping Israel support on Israel was to come. But I think, frankly, there was a prior. And the prior is that already with Trump, Israel had to start waning this sale of dual technology to China. So, the whole thing gets worse with Gaza, but there is also a very important background before Gaza that needs to be considered. And I think the consideration here is that Israel just couldn't continue to do what it was doing. And I think this is a big lesson for Israel, because at the end of the day, now what happens, as Plamen said, is that ironically, in the early 2010s, Israel probably felt, okay, we're important for China, But now China is important for Israel, because on the import side, yeah, electrolyzers, you name it, China produces stuff that Israel cannot get from anywhere else. And that thing, and given Israel's size on top of everything, is a killer, because you felt you were in the opposite situation. So now China has every space, if you want, yeah, to play this Gaza game, if I can call it that way, without Israel being able to do much about it. So, and I think this is really the concept of weaponizing strategic dependence. People say interdependences, but by now it's probably dependencies. And even Israel got into this. So, you know, imagine others. Just that idea that, oh, you're surfing the wave and suddenly you are below the wave and somebody's surfing on your head. Yeah. I think that's exactly the lesson, in my view, that Israel has learned. And it's a very important lesson for the rest of the world.
Indeed, I was about just to say that Israel is not the only country that is facing this dilemma right now. That's for sure. We have a bit more of time, so I was wondering maybe we can also talk a bit about Greece and Cyprus, because it's also countries in this region and they are directly members of the European Union. So China's economic presence there would also have a more direct implications of its relations with the EU. Maybe Plamen, could I start with you?
Right. Thanks, Yiyun. On Greece, I would say that, of course, the big story here is Costco's investment in the port of Piraeus. It's a story that's known worldwide, and it's, I would call it, the jewel in the BRI crown of China. The Chinese are very proud of this particular investment, rightly so. And, of course, it is very much talked about. I would say that if you look behind the facade of this investment, it is not that important for the Greek economy, or at least the terms of the contract between Costco and the Greek state are heavily tilted towards the Chinese side. The Greek economy does not, you know, ensure the socioeconomic benefits it expected to ensure when this contract was first struck back in 2009, and then in 2016, Costco took over the entire facility of the Piraeus port. And then there was yet another amendment in 2021 when Costco's stake went up to 67% of the overall Piraeus port stock. But I would say that this project is very much talked about, whereas its contribution in terms of benefits for the Greek economy is much more limited. And there's yet another Chinese investment. In fact, it's a portfolio investment to the tune of 24% of the stock of the high voltage grid operator in Greece. But I would say that doesn't make a big difference. This is more or less all when it comes to Chinese FDI in Greece. In political terms, I would say that yes, Greece is considered to be one of the relatively China-friendly countries in the EU. And China, of course, is eager to include, to have Greece as part of a China-friendly constituency in Europe, in political terms. When it comes to Cyprus, of course, is a very special case because it's been split since 1974. And there's this never-ending conflict between Cyprus and Turkey. And then there's a lot of tension between Greece and Turkey. The Chinese, very wisely, I would say, stay away from this. They do not want to undertake any role, you know, in the mediating between all these parties. And in fact, they've been very careful in the Eastern Mediterranean not to get embroiled in any conflict, neither in Syria, nor in Libya, nor in Cyprus, nor between Greece and Turkey. But when it comes to Chinese investment in Cyprus, it's a really interesting story. They only invest in one single sector, real estate. And there are some murky stories about Chinese investors in real estate in Cyprus in return for the so-called golden passports. If you remember the Al Jazeera report, which came out in 2020, and it really revealed a lot of unpleasant stuff, let me put it mildly, in the way Russian and Chinese investors and others acquire golden, basically European passports in return for their investment. I would say that there are some revealing facts in a recent report that I had the pleasure of drafting on relations between China and Cyprus. And the title is revealing itself, Behind the Facade of Sino-Cypriot Relations.
Perfect. That's super interesting, Plamen. We'll make sure to make a link in the show notes to your interesting report. So if listeners are interested, you can also click to read more about this. It has come to the end of our podcast, and we've been discussing so many countries in the region, and we talked about how China's method has been highly customized and highly adaptable to individual members. So what would be your recommendation to the EU when it comes to dealing with this region, and then what lessons can they learn from China, maybe? And how do you think this could impact EU in the Eastern Mediterranean region? I'll start with you, Alicia.
One thing to note is that listening to this podcast or anything you read for that matter, it seems that there's only China and Egypt, that there's only China and Turkey. And actually, when you look at the investment numbers, foreign direct investment, but even trade, Europe is extremely important. It's just that for whatever reason, and I wish I would understand why, we don't seem to exist. But actually, when you look at the numbers, I mean, we have a free trade zone for auto parts with Turkey, which is probably one of the best, most important sources of employment for manufacturing employment in Turkey. China is not offering that to Turkey. But at the same time, it would look as if Europe is retrenching from any of the countries we've mentioned other than the members, you know. So the question is, why can't we make more out of the money, if you want, we're investing in these countries? Yeah, I mean, how can it be that we're invisible? And I think this is both a question of, you know, narrative, I don't know. I mean, I wish we would have you put, I'm going to put it very bluntly, a podcast, same as this one, talking about what Europe is doing in Egypt, in Turkey. No, shouldn't we? Because at the end of the day, I feel like I myself, I'm promoting what China is doing in, which has nothing wrong with that. But in a way, I feel we're very, how to say, we just don't show what we're doing. And I think that's the lesson for me, the biggest lesson I have to learn from this. Because yes, China is pervasive, but we're too. Maybe we're not a nation. Maybe, you know, there's many reasons why we're not as visible, which relates to our fragmentation. But beyond that, yeah, it's just mind-boggling. So I would say, if somebody out there in our audience could tell us as much as Plamen has told us about China's presence in these Mediterranean countries, but about Europe, we can sign up for another podcast and invite this person right there to tell us what Europe is doing in the Mediterranean countries. That would be wonderful.
Maybe we can also invite some officials from the European Union to tell us more about that. Plamen, what do you think? Do you think there's a publicity issue with the EU?
Yes. I think that what Alethea means, what she's referring to, is called strategic communication. And I understand it's one of the priorities of the European Commission. I think that, yes, China has managed to send across its messages. It's been fairly successful in terms of messaging. I'm sure you're aware of this Chinese campaign, Tell China Story Well. What we need in Europe is to tell Europe's story well. And this is a matter of strategic communication. And I would say what we need is a concerted approach. 27 member states should speak in one voice, you know, selling Europe abroad. And that something's definitely amiss there. But let me offer a couple of bullet points as key takeaways from this discussion, which I find very interesting, and thank you and Alethea, for the pleasure of talking to you. A couple of bullet points. First of all, we've got electric cars being produced by Chinese car makers in countries like Turkey, possibly in Egypt, and all the way to Morocco in Northern Africa. So what we're seeing is a ring of industrial facilities, around Europe, to the south of Europe, definitely targeting the European market. At the same time, we are seeing Chinese investment in Egypt, in the energy sector, and as I told you previously, obviously Europe again is the market for these green energy facilities, of these green energy projects. At the same time, a very interesting case again in Egypt, in the Suez Canal Economic Zone, relates to a fiber optics producer. It's a Chinese company producing fiber optics, targeting the European market. And there are very many complaints lodged by European glass fiber producers against these Chinese manufacturers in Egypt. Their point is that these fiber optic products coming from Egypt have a label made in Egypt, but in fact, they are made by Chinese companies through state subsidies, Chinese state subsidies, which then allow the Chinese companies to lower the prices artificially. So what we're seeing is that in the Eastern Mediterranean and perhaps throughout the entire Mediterranean basin, we have growing Chinese presence, and in economic terms, it basically targets the European market. So I'd say that there may be some benefits in this, of course, and we should look for benefits as well. But my point is that the EU should also take measures to prevent cases of unfair competition, such as dumping, low environmental and labor standards, which are distinctive features of what I would call the Chinese way of doing business. We should be aware of this, and we should definitely have a well-thought-out strategy when it comes to Chinese presence in the Mediterranean.
Thank you very much. That was a very sobering message and a very important note to take on. Thank you, Plamen, and thank you, Alicia, for joining us for this podcast conversation. It has been a pleasure talking to you about the Eastern Mediterranean region, which we have not touched much upon on. Like Alicia mentioned, maybe in the future we'll be interested in doing more episodes about the region, about its strategic importance, and I hope to maybe welcome Plamen back again to have another conversation with us. To all the listeners, you can find our research at Bruegel.org, also Plamen's paper about Sino-Cypriot relations in the show notes below. Until next time, bye-bye.